Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
You know, in life, no matter how much you are down, if you are willing to give your best and fight, you know, you can always have a fighting chance to come back.
We had to rise from the ashes.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga in Nairobi, and here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. The DRC is battling a more dangerous strain of monkeypox. We'll hear from an expert about what's known about the disease so far. And we'll look at a recent event celebrating the ballroom culture for the underground LGBTQ in Nigeria.
The ball was just like an avenue to share queer joy. It was just like created as an escape for people to have an avenue to be themselves and just like showcase whatever they wanted to.
It's Thursday, June 27th. First, we go to West Africa. Ministers of ECOWAS countries are meeting today in Abuja to discuss the formation of a new regional force against terrorism and unconstitutional government changes. The talks come amidst a rise in jihadist activity across the Sahel and recent departures from ECOWAS following a string of coups. Now, Professor Kwesi Anning is a security and political analyst at the Kofi Annan International Peacekeeping Training Center in Ghana. What's his analysis on a new regional force?
My approach is very simple. There are way too many institutions and frameworks for security. So why add another one when the already existing ones don't function or you can't fund them?
Is your opinion that there should not be another force being formed? Because the thing is, you are saying they do not work. So there is a security problem still ongoing. There seems to be a security vacuum. What do you propose?
Well, proper training, better risk assessment and analysis, better equipment, more targeted use of intelligence. I mean, this is not rocket science. But I think our leaders are being pushed to accept a set of threat assessments that do not necessarily speak to the reality on the ground.
And I think
we have the Accra Initiative. I think quite a number of our external partners are seeing whatever they perceive to be insecurities in their own countries as emanating from Africa or from the Sahel, and therefore XYZ policies must be put in place. Now, the question really is, do those policies necessarily benefit those who are supposed to be the recipients of the aid? We can look at Nigeria, we can look at Mali. Almost every security framework that our partners have suggested, from the African Crisis Response Initiative to whatever, name it, okay, it's just a fashion for the period. Lots of noise, a few equipments thrown in, some training, but they do not touch the core of what the security challenges are.
I want you to tell us about that core of what the problem is. Could you describe it to us and tell us what you would say the solution? But first, start by telling us what the core of the problem is and why they seem not to understand it.
My travels in the Sahel and West Africa tells me that democratic governance is not delivering the social welfare goods that citizens are looking for. That's number one. Number two, that the allure of getting access to the public space is what drives this thirst for political power, creating a chasm between what those seeking for power tell the citizenry and what they actually deliver when the citizens hand over power to them. So there's a lacuna between the rhetoric of delivery and the actual capacity to deliver, leading to a mistrust, suspicion, and increasing anger. Now, across the Sahel and West Africa, poverty is deepening, but we are seeing also a disturbing, totally unacceptable rise in corruption. So those who want to strike a blow at our communities and the state, they don't need any reasons nor excuses. because people are providing them on a silver platter. And it is these domestic imperatives that we need to look at. They're chasing some fancy narratives about the terrorists are coming. Is there violence in the Sahel and West Africa? Certainly. But the way we are approaching it is not a reality. We are not willing to say, can we deliver public service goods and make governance accountable to the needs of the people who have put us where we are in public office? Until and unless we bridge this gap, we will be talking insecurity, we will be forming new multilateral structures, our partners will be pumping in money and equipment and training, for which some people will be very grateful. That does not touch the core of the problem.
Okay, so you've talked about poverty, corruption, insecurity. You also mentioned something about the democratic governance not delivering. But then, Professor, I do not think you would argue that the military takeovers, for instance, have delivered the social goods that you're talking about, would you?
I think if we take Niger, Burkina Faso and Mali, they may not have delivered the social goods in the interim. Let's not forget they've had democratic, you know, processes for years that neither delivered. But we are using a different yardstick to say, oh, look at Niger. You know, the terrorists are all over the place. Are we also not sure that those who want to undermine the government are playing dirty games? That's number one. Number two, if we take Niger, there were 9 different countries, billions of dollars spent on infrastructure, on training, on equipment. And if those who were deepening democracy in Niger and fighting terror could not use their early warning and risk assessments and threat analysis to stand that there was some discontent in the army, that President Bazoum bringing in the French will escalate the discontent, then we need to question the effectiveness of the types of security force assistance that quite a number of our partners are telling us to take.
You talked about external partners. Who were you referring to in your previous answer?
Specifically, France and the United States.
Right. And we've seen those two being asked to leave in some of these countries, actually in the Sahel countries where we've had military leaders come into power. Do these countries, specifically France and the US, need to be part of the conversation with the existing ECOWAS members about what can be done about insecurity and military takeovers in the West African region in general?
No, I don't think for now they should be. Part of the challenge for most African countries, and let's focus on Sahel and West Africa, is that we have almost never been able to have a conversation amongst ourselves without people looking over our shoulders and whispering how or what the direction of the conversation should be. Now, any country in which France reestablishes itself will experience some level of upheaval because they don't seem to have learned over the last couple of years the sense of frustration that the citizenry feel. We know from history that U.S. support is very flighty. It changes just like the wind. We've had ACRI, the African Crisis Response Initiative. We've had all sorts of initiatives that do not last. And I want to raise this point, Charles, that if all these capacity-building interventions were meant truly to build the capacities of Africa's armies, we would have been built.
If you were in the room with these ministers or later on with the heads of states in ECOWAS, what kind of solution would you present to them as what you think would work, a silver bullet kind of a solution?
Well, I think it would be a useless exercise because they wouldn't follow through.
Let's assume they will follow.
I'm sitting in the chair myself. No. No, they will not follow through. And I think it will be a useless exercise. Were I to have that authority, so far as you have signed on to that document and the principles and the values inherent in those documents, then they must be applied consistently and without fear nor favor.
Your argument is that the existing ECOWAS policies are enough to deal with the problems there. They just need to be implemented. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. That they are more than enough to prevent And when they occur, deal with them and to create a stable, functional, developing societies.
One would argue then the time is of the essence and this needs to be done quite urgently, right, Professor?
I don't think we should beat about the bush. ECOWAS is celebrating 50 years of existence next May. Right now, we are staring at ECOWAS's disintegration or a new leadership that transforms the way that it does its business. Right now, we don't have that type of leadership. And no foreign support to build bases in West Africa will solve that problem of existential threat.
Professor, we'll leave it there for today. Thank you for your insights.
Thank you very much, Charles.
Professor Kwesi Aneng. And now to something viral and worrisome, a new strain of the mpox virus. Cases of the disease are on the rise in several African countries. Just this week, South Africa recorded its third death from the infection, with more than a dozen cases confirmed. Let's take a listen to South Africa's Health Minister, Dr. Joe Paschler, who gave a briefing about the virus when it was first detected in the country.
South Africa is amongst the countries currently experiencing current outbreak. A viral this infection, which, as I've already said, spreads from one person to another, although also being transmitted from animals. All cases and all the patients are males aged between 30 and 39 years without any travel history to other countries which are experiencing outbreaks.
That's Dr. Joe Paschler, South Africa's health minister. Just this week, the country recorded its third death and has 16 laboratory-confirmed cases so far. Now, this new strain has also been spreading quickly along the eastern border of the Democratic Republic of Congo, and some health ministers have called it the most dangerous strain yet, and it warned it could spread across borders. We wanted to understand more about this virus, and for that, I reached out to Dr. Jean-Claude Udahemuka, who's based at the University of Rwanda in Kigali.
Monkeypox is a viral disease which is zoonotic. It was firstly found in monkeys, where's the name, but recently it has been changed from monkeypox to mpox. And since last year, there was another variant which we found and identified in Eastern DRC in South Kivu, and that is the one we are currently working on these days.
Right, so there's this new strain in the DRC, like you're mentioning, and it's been described as the most dangerous one yet. Why is that, and how different is it from the previous strains?
Well, to start with, it's a new strain because there are some changes in the genome of what we used to know. There are mutations that that we identified with the publication we released, some works we did in February, and the publication was released later. We found that there were some mutations, and the mutation targeted a region of the genome that was targeted by diagnostic assays that were recommended by CDC. So this called immediately for designing new assays. So the PCR assay that was traditionally targeting or detecting the clade was no longer working. And also in the field, we found new transmission ways, such as it used to be homosexually transmitted, but in this case, we are looking at heterosexual transmission. It started in a group of sex workers in a certain mining city in South Kivu in bars. And then also it is being transmitted from person to person. But there are still many unknowns. So we are still conducting some research and responding to some questions, such as household and other serology works, to understand really, really how this strain is behaving. But since then, it has gone out of that small city and broke into other cities in DRC, in Eastern DRC.
Right. So tell us why it's dangerous and what are some of the symptoms that people experience once they get infected with mpox?
Some of the symptoms are skin lesions. It comes with skin lesions, and because this is a sexually transmitted, most of the time skin lesions are found on genital organs, which makes it complicated to spot someone who has it, because those are secret organs. You can't spot them with someone walking outside. But sometimes it comes also on arms or in the face, and also we have seen some long-term effects also. Some people who even got healed, but got lifelong problems like losing eyesight and also fever. We've been seeing miscarriages with pregnant women, but also the babies who are infants who are born with it when their mothers were infected. So the symptoms are quietly similar with the other clades or the other strains, but with some changes, which we still need to investigate and come up with a decision to say that it is really, really different. Because what we are seeing are observational, but we need data to have a solid ground to make decisions.
Right. So you did mention that it is sexually transmitted. Is that the only way in which it is transmitted?
The answer is no. We have also observed that there can be transmissions between people just touching each other.
So is there a cure or vaccines, for instance, and how quickly should the vaccines or the treatment be administered?
Yes, there is a drug that is recommended by WHO, and that is Tecovirimat, and it's been used all over the world. And also there's a vaccine. Actually, the mpox virus is close to the smallpox virus. And as you know, the smallpox virus was stopped in African countries around 1980s. So the people who were born before that probably got vaccinated against smallpox. And the people who are vaccinated against smallpox are somehow protected against mpox, but they would need maybe a second shot. And the people can be vaccinated today with that vaccine containing the vaccinia virus, which is the same as smallpox virus, and they can get some immunity level.
And let's talk about whether we should be concerned, Doctor, about this disease spreading, especially across borders, and how should the countries be preparing for that kind of incidences, if they can happen?
Yes, I think there's that possibility of crossing borders from DRC to other parts, because like any other infectious disease, right now as we speak, it is no longer contained in that city of Kamituga. It is outside of Kamituga. It has been detected in the city of Bukavu, in the city of Goma, in the city of Kamanyola, in Uvira, and those are the cities that are on the borders with the neighboring countries, with DRC, including Burundi, Rwanda, and Uganda. And the city of Kamituga is a city where it is connected to other East African countries via the ports of Mombasa and Dar es Salaam. So anytime a truck driver, because this is a trend we have seen with HIV also in the 90s, the truck driver can be infected, not only a truck driver, any other passenger, and travel to any other country and infect other people knowingly or unknowingly, because you can get infected and spend some day without knowing that you're infected, yet you may be infecting others. So it can take between 15 to 21 days before the first symptoms appear, yet one is infected. I think one thing is make sure that the vaccines are available to especially groups that are at high risk, but also detect on borders. I think the countries in East Africa are equipped. They've been facing Ebola. They've been facing other infectious diseases, and they know how to deal with migration. So I think they should start putting detection methods or measures at the entry points in their countries.
So you did mention about the countries in Central and also East Africa and how they are faring on with this disease. But also we are seeing cases in South Africa. You say that strain is different from what we've seen in the DRC, for example. So how different is it, and what do South Africans need to be aware of?
In South Africa, from what I know, in South Africa, it's a different strain, similar to what has been circulating in Europe and North America. But from what I know, the cases identified so far, they have no travel history to those places. So probably something is unknown. Maybe they were in contact with other people who traveled and they got infected. So I think anyone should be prepared. Anyone should be ready to detect, to fight the disease, because it can come at any time.
And how contagious is that strain? Is it more contagious than the others, or is it just as contagious as the others?
That we don't know. It's actually, I think, it's among the things we don't know yet, but we are still working on some research questions such as like that one, because some of the research questions about household transmission are still ongoing. So I don't think I can say that is more contagious, except that I think, but we don't have a solid ground to state that.
Generally then, Dr. John, how concerned should people be and what do people need to do to avoid picking up mpox?
People should not maybe panic, but they should know that there is that threat, health threat, that is sexually transmitted. And like in the case of HIV, avoid having multiple partners. And it's not like protected intercourse, because that I don't think that will protect, because the issue is having that skin-to-skin contact. So avoiding multiple partners would be easy, or observing hygiene measures like what we were doing during COVID, we learned a lot. And I think that will help. And also health authorities will in countries will release other measures according to WHO.
Dr. John Claude Udahemuka in Kigali. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. The month of June is often designated as the LGBTQ plus Pride Month. It is a month-long celebration of the LGBTQ plus community worldwide. But in many parts of Africa, the queer community face entrenched anti-LGBTQ plus sentiments. Over the past 2 years, countries like Uganda and Ghana have introduced stricter anti-gay laws. Despite these challenges, young Africans in the community have found ways to celebrate Pride Month. In Lagos, Nigeria's commercial capital, the community came together to celebrate the country's ballroom culture earlier this month. This culture, inspired by the underground drag balls in the US, includes dancing, voguing, walking, performing and modeling in various categories. Although same-sex partnerships are illegal in Nigeria, the ballroom scene persists underground. This month, LGBTQ plus Nigerians held the Fola Francis Bola to honor Fola, a transgender icon who passed away last year. Some of the attendees spoke to the BBC, and here is what they had to say.
I want to celebrate Fola. When I first started going out, like, she's like one of the people that made me feel confident enough to start like really going outside and being myself.
This is my first ball. I have always wanted to be here. This is a dream come true. I'm here today because of Fola. She was a very loving, supportive person. And it's very sad for me because I met her and 3 days later she died. And she was supposed to actually help me through my transitioning to coming to Lagos. So it was very personal to me too.
I spoke with Liba, a trans femme in Lagos who participated in the ball, and began by sharing the experience at the event.
So there was a ball at the start of the month to celebrate Pride for queer people living in Lagos. And it was also an avenue to honor the late Fola Francis, a trans woman. So it's named the Fola Francis Ball. And essentially, it was just like open for like queer people to come and share their pride, because she hosted the last one last year before she passed. So basically, the ball was just like an avenue to share queer joy for the people living in Lagos, like despite all of the laws and hardship that like people have to face on the regular, it was just like created as an escape for people to have an avenue to be themselves and just like showcase whatever they wanted to.
It does sound like the event was a special tribute to Fola Francis, who was a transgender icon who died last year.
Yeah.
Tell us whether you had a personal connection with her and, you know, share a bit about that.
Oh, yes, I did have a personal relationship with her and we shared a very beautiful friendship.
So from what I can see here, you were one of Fola's chosen daughters, part of the LGBTQ plus community in Nigeria. Is that a unique experience? Tell us a bit more about that.
For me, it was community, right? Like, she extended a large portion of her community to me, and that helped me through a lot.
Let's broaden this up then and look at how it is like to be visibly queer or gay in Nigeria. What can you tell us about this, drawing from your own personal experience?
From my personal experience, it is incredibly hard because you get a lot of punching down and pushback from, like, the media. But you also have to be very cautious, like, because of their laws and, you don't want to get in trouble with like the law. I would say it's a big risk that's taken to just be oneself, knowing that like whatever risk I have to face, I'm facing it while being 100% myself. I'm not shielding or trying to be what I'm not.
Yeah, so you've talked about being incredibly hard, avoiding being in trouble with the law. Are there any safe spaces in Lagos, for example?
Oh,
it's a
absolutely.
Big city where you can go and you're allowed to be yourself. Tell us about that.
Oh, yes, there are. So there's events like the balls that are hosted, and there are like other events that are hosted by different NGOs and different initiatives to create like safe spaces for queer people living in Lagos. I hosted an open mic event for Pride earlier in the month. There was like also like a souk for like queer vendors to be able to showcase like their products, or like healing aromatic wellness sessions. There's a lot of events that like different queer people put in place to create safe spaces for each other.
Right. So they are the safe spaces where you can feel free and express yourself. And you can perhaps tell us when you came out and how your family or friends or people that know you handled that.
I feel for me, it's a very different scenario because I feel like I was very sure of like the support I would get from my friends before I took the step to come out to them. And as for family, I never really bothered to come out to them. I just like generally avoided them.
Let's talk about what's happening in other parts of the continent. There are quite strict laws, even in the neighboring country, Ghana, and in other places as well, like Uganda. We've been reporting about these issues. What are your thoughts on how the LGBTQ plus community is being treated in other parts of the continent and in some of the countries that I've mentioned?
This is horrible. This is really horrible. My heart is out to every queer person that has to live with those realities. Because I know I have a couple of friends, or like I've been able to reach a bunch of people who live in those countries, and I've been able to hear firsthand like how they have to navigate. And it's like, of course, it's not like it's easier here, but like at the same time, it's just like, why is there so much punching down on like the community within like the continent, right? It shows that there's no care for citizens. It's just all always propaganda. They throw things at the queer community to hide their own failures. So it's very disturbing.
And what are your hopes for Nigeria then? You've said it's not like it's easy in Nigeria itself. What can Nigeria do to make things right in your perspective?
Firstly, there needs to be a recognition of queer people in Nigeria as people, as human beings. Like, there's need for humanization, and then there's need for there to be laws in place to further protect us as a class, as a group, as a community. And I feel like if those two things are not first put in place, like we can't make like much progress.
All right, Liba, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Liba at Transfem in Lagos. And that's Focus on Africa today. It was produced by Bella Hassan, Sunita Nahar, and Amy Leibovitz in London. Connie Sharp was the senior journalist in charge. Our technical producer was Chris Ablakwa. Our editors are Andrea Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Charles Gitonga. We'll speak again next time.